This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Do you constantly split infinitives, start sentences with and or but, or end sentences with a preposition? Well, have no fear, you've done nothing wrong. It seems many of the grammar rules that we've been following over the years are completely bogus.
People have studied how it got to be considered a rule, and basically some guys made it up in the 18th century.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to an English professor about the 7 bogus grammar errors that you don't need to worry about, and a lot more about the state of writing in general. We'll also spend an academic minute with another form of writing, tattoos, and see what effect they can have on job interviews. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Anyone who has sat through English 101 knows there are a lot of rules to think about when writing. Proper grammar, proper punctuation, just using the right words all have to be taken into account. And don't even get me started about dangling modifiers. But it seems some of the rules that a lot of writers live by are totally bogus. Ben Yagoda is an author and a professor of English and journalism at the University of Delaware. This past spring, in TheWeek.com, he published an article called 7 Bogus Grammar Errors You Don't Need to Worry About. And you'll notice in the title of that article, he breaks one of those bogus grammar rules. We spoke in the spring, and I asked him about that rule, which I have followed religiously. Never end a sentence with a preposition.
No, not at all. It's as the title says, it's a bogus rule. People have studied how it got to be considered a rule, and basically some guys made it up in the 18th century who were under the impression that English should be more like Latin. And I'm not a Latin scholar, but my understanding is that it's not possible to end a sentence with a preposition in Latin, and so they felt English should be the same way. But there's nothing about the grammar of the English language that says that you shouldn't do that.
How does something like that catch on after all these years?
Well, I don't know, but I guess my hunch would be that people seem to have a lot of insecurity about language. I've certainly experienced that themselves. Sometimes it's justified insecurity, sometimes maybe not so much. So if someone with a doctor in front of their name and a lot of authority, a lot of self-confidence comes along and says something as a rule, or maybe a stern eighth grade teacher says something as a rule, I think human nature is inclined to believe them.
Another one of the bogus grammar errors you come up with was don't start a sentence with a conjunction. And that's, again, another one that I've always lived by.
Right. This one was interesting as well in how it started. Again, it's nothing, there's no rule, there's nothing wrong with it. And here's one that people who wrote books about English uses and grammar, the first time they started writing about this rule was to say that there is no such rule. And no one has been able to find a book that actually says it is a rule. There's a scholar named Dennis Barron who found only one book that briefly mentioned it. But this is a rule that is got picked up without any even so-called experts espousing it, as some of the others did have.
And another one you come up with, and this makes sense to me, is don't be afraid of using words that mean something different than they used to.
Right. If you pick up the Oxford English Dictionary, which is probably my favorite book in the world, that shows you how geeky I am. But the great thing about that dictionary, either in a print or online version of it, is that it's a historical dictionary. So it shows you how the meanings of words have changed. So I don't like to use the word every, but I would hazard to say that every single word that's in that book has had meanings that have changed over time, over the centuries, if not the decades. So that if you pick any word, I think the one I used in the example was astonish. Originally, that meant turn to stone, astonish stone. You can see the root in the word. And over time, it came to mean to surprise, or to really surprise, as a metaphor. So I'm so surprised, it's as if I have literally, that's another one of those words that you have to be careful about, literally turned to stone. The metaphor became so popular that astonish took on that metaphorical meaning as its main meaning. So no one, if you wanted to say something turned to stone, no one would know what you meant if you said astonish anymore. So some people like to stick to meanings that really have changed, but and that's fine if they want to do that for their own writing, but it's not really fair to criticize others for adopting a meaning that really has changed.
You give quite a few examples in the article, like to mean such as, and decimate to mean kill or eliminate, but the one you give on the bottom there is you say it's okay to say I could care less when you really mean I couldn't care less.
Right. I put that in maybe to try to provoke some argument, because I know that's one that gets people very mad. And that's obviously a phrase, not just a word. And I couldn't care less means that it's a bit of exaggeration, hyperbolic, but what you've just told me or what we're talking about, I care so little about it that it would be impossible for me to care less about it than I do. So it's a bit of a rhetorical statement. Somewhere along the line, someone who is ironic or sarcastic or something, instead of saying, I couldn't care less, said, I could care less. And it kind of sounds like it's the same meaning, although if you analyzed it and took it apart literally, it would not mean that. But as with words, idioms are expressions we use, and they very frequently don't seem to even have an apparent meaning, or at least don't follow their original meaning. So if you're certainly speaking or writing in a casual, conversational way, there's nothing wrong with saying, I could care less, to mean I couldn't care less. Certainly everyone will understand exactly what you mean.
Well, you have a new book out called How Not to Write Bad, and I took a look through the book, and could you please explain to us what is an egg corn?
Sure. Well, first of all, I have to respectfully correct you, and you have edited or corrected the title of my book.
Uh-oh, what'd I do?
Well, it's another one of those things I wrote about in the article about the bogus grammar errors that you didn't mention, but it is the bogus so-called error of not to split an infinitive or not to brazenly split an infinitive. Again, to be a little bit provocative, I split an infinitive in the title of the book, and it's called How to Not Write Bad. But your middle school teacher probably told you never, 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 never split an infinitive. So you unconsciously probably changed the title to How Not to Write Bad.
I absolutely did that. Thank you.
And I only corrected you just because it makes an interesting point. And I would have to say about 40% of the people who say the title of the book make that exact same mistake, which is pretty interesting. Now, your question was about the acorns, and the acorn is, I believe my colleague, someone else who writes for the same blog I do, which is called Lingua Franca at the Chronicle of Higher Education. It's a blog about language and writing and some of these issues. His name is Jeffrey Pullum. I believe he coined the term acorn, which is E-G-G-C-O-R-N, and what it means is he found or had read about people who wrote acorn, the thing that falls off the oak tree, A-C-O-R-N, they thought it was spelled or even pronounced eggcorn, E-G-G-C-O-R-N. And that has become a common way of spelling the word. And the quality of that concept of acorn is not just that it's wrong, but that it makes a certain kind of sense, because an acorn is actually shaped like an egg. So hence the name acorn. And there are a lot of great examples. A former student of mine is an English teacher, a high school English teacher, emailed me the other day and said her students think that the concept of hand-me-down clothes, hand-me-down from my older brother or my uncle, they think, and they write it as hand-me-down, H-A-M-M-Y-D-O-W-N, because they think there's something, I don't know, hammy or about it. It makes a certain kind of sense. Another one that I've heard a lot is the phrase dog eat dog world. A lot of people render that as doggy dog world, like D-O-G-G-Y hyphen D-O-G world. And again, it makes a kind of sense. There's a kind of poetry in some of these mistakes.
It reminds me of someone I know who used to ask me about the windshield factor.
The windshield, right. It makes sense, doesn't it? You want to shield yourself from the wind. I think we're in a golden age, if I can be a little ironic, of these eggcorns because of spell check. People write, they expect to be a squiggly red line under anything that's wrong. So if they write something that is spelled correctly, yet it's the wrong word, spell check seems to say, okay, that's fine. And people aren't very good spellers nowadays. So a lot of my students' papers, I get examples of this. A colleague of mine got, on one of his assignments, someone who referred to her friend's pompous boyfriend, P-A-M-P-A-S, instead of P-O-M-P-O-U-S, which, you know, I assumed he was from Argentina, because that's where the pompas are.
What do you have against the semicolon?
I've got a bad rap on that. Let me explain it this way. I only have one thing against the semicolon, and that's when it's misused. I think it's a fine piece of punctuation.
I'm going to quote your book right now.
Okay.
If you feel like using a semicolon, lie down until the urge goes away.
I think you may have left out the prefatory. I sometimes feel like saying, I meant to say that. And I feel that, I sometimes feel that way because many people misuse the semicolon. They use it in place of a colon, and they're two very different pieces of punctuation with different meanings. Now, you got me started on punctuation. If I'm geeky about anything, it's punctuation. So don't get me started on the dash.
Hey, you can dash all you want right here. This is an education program.
Okay. I love punctuation. I wrote a piece for the New York Times draft section called The Most Comma Mistakes.
Oh.
And about problems that people have using the comma. And it was the most read article on the whole NewYorkTimes.com website of the past 30 days for 24 days in a row. So people, oddly, are interested in this subject. I'm not exactly sure why, but they are.
What's the Oxford comma?
The Oxford comma refers to the, the question of when you have a list of items, red, white, and blue, or my best friends are Bill, Tom, Ted, and George, you obviously have a comma after Bill, comma, Tom, comma. Then I said, Ted and George, do you put a comma after Ted and before the and or not? If you read The New Yorker, they do. If you read The New York Times, they do not. And putting the comma there is known as the Oxford comma, I think named after the Oxford University Press, which in their house style uses that comma there. And if you Google Oxford comma and look on the internet, you'll be amazed at how heated the battles are over one versus the other. I'm a bit of an agnostic on the question. I guess I just say choose one, but try to be consistent.
Well, you know, this brings up something that I don't know if this is something you have an opinion on, but I once read an article online, and it had so many comments, they just went for thousands. When you are typing, and you type a period, one space or two.
I know. It was an article in Slate magazine, and I believe that was the most read, most commented article of all time. So go figure. Yeah, I have to be honest with you. I don't really have an opinion on it. And until I became aware of that controversy, I wasn't even aware that it was a controversy. I had a vague idea that some people in the past at some point had habitually put two spaces, but I didn't think people did it anymore, and didn't know why they did it in the first place. So it's a bit of a mystery to me, but I know people are very passionate about that as well.
I'll tell you why we did it in the first place. Sister Mary Stevens in eighth grade on my IBM Selectric said two spaces after the period.
Sister Mary started it all.
That's her fault.
She probably had some colleagues around the world who were spreading the gospel as well.
In more ways than one, yes.
Right.
Still to come, our conversation with Ben Yagoda about the rules of grammar continues with a look at what texting shorthand has done to writing. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about the best of our knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for the Best of Our Knowledge, number 1214. This is the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Ben Yagoda, a professor of English and journalism at the University of Delaware. We're talking about grammar, writing, and what happens when good writers make bad mistakes. I asked him if he thinks that in his experience, the conventional wisdom about texting, shorthand, and email language bringing down the quality of writing is true.
Well, you know, I don't know. It's kind of complicated. When you read op-ed pieces and articles about the decline of writing skills, you often find the charge that people write and use LOL or smiley faces or texting slang or write the letter U instead of the word Y-O-U, which I don't even think people do anymore in texting. I think that's a bit outmoded. But I've been teaching in college for this is my 21st year, and I've never gotten any of those things in an assignment. Young people who write texts a certain way and comments on Twitter and Facebook and things like that, they're not dumb. They understand that that's not appropriate for a school assignment. But I do think it's a more subtle problem in that, as with spelling and punctuation, the best way to really learn these things, to learn about writing, to also learn unexpected facts about the world and history and life and everything, is just by reading a lot of work that has been edited, whether it's online or in print, all different kinds of work. And I feel that there isn't enough reading going on so that people, when it's time to write, either for publication or for a class or in a business environment, they're not comfortable with that. They don't really know. It's almost like they've been wearing shorts their whole life and said, okay, you have to go to wear a suit and tie. They don't know how to tie the tie. They know they have to do something different, but they don't know quite how to do it.
You're in the trenches. You're seeing these students and reading their work all the time. Is there still good writing coming up?
There really is. There's no question about it. And it's so much fun to come upon a student who is talented and interested and either has read or is willing to read, has something that he or she wants to write about. And the other thing about the online world is that if you look at blogs and even Twitter and Facebook and some of these new venues, I feel there's a lot of really good writing going on. It's a conversational kind of writing. A lot of it is a little insidey, a little snarky. But, you know, Horace, the ancient writer, said that the purpose of writing was to instruct and delight. And a lot of this has interesting things to say, and it's funny, clever, personal. So one of my goals as a teacher is to try to get some of my students are really excellent writers when they're writing for their blog about hip-hop music or what have you, to use some of those skills or transfer some of those skills to writing to a more general audience. It can be done, and when they do it, it's really fun to see. It's not necessarily that easy, but it can be done.
It certainly is possible for somebody just from anywhere to have their writing read by thousands of people now, instantly.
Well, you know, you're so right. You create a blog. Now, we have to make a distinction. I can start a blog even as we're talking on WordPress or Blogger. I apologize for my dog. He's in the background. He agrees with what I'm saying.
Everybody's a critic.
But so I can create a blog even as we're speaking, and not only thousands but millions, in fact, billions of people could potentially read it, but they won't read it unless there's some reason to. So it's a kind of ironic situation that I can put out a blog that everybody in the world could potentially read, but probably only my best friend and my mother and my father will read. So it used to be that a writer just had to please an editor, and if the editor of the New York Times or the New Yorker or some other publication liked it, it would go out there and it would be published. Now you can publish yourself, but that you also have to become salesman, a promoter, a marketer, and get people to read what you have to say. Once they do, once you get the ball rolling, I think it is a bit of a meritocracy in that the good stuff rises to the top, but getting going is really challenging. That and getting paid for it is challenging as well.
That's the important part, yeah.
Samuel Johnson said, no one but a blockhead ever wrote for any reason other than money. And it seems like there's a lot of blockheads around now because a lot of people are writing for free, but that's a whole other topic.
Ben Yagoda is a professor of English and journalism at the University of Delaware. His latest book is called How Not to Write Bad, published by Riverhead Books. You can also read his article on the 7 bogus grammar errors online in the March 5th issue of TheWeek.com. So we heard about the rules of writing. What about the rules of writing and drawing on our bodies? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. Tattoos have become increasingly popular in recent decades, but most people say that their skin art is usually hidden from view. Andrew Timming, reader in management at the University of St. Andrews, discusses why visible tattoos may hurt the most during a job interview.
Thinking about getting a tattoo? Hold that thought. In a recent paper, I looked at the effects of visible tattoos on employment chances. I say visible tattoos because if your tattoos are concealable, then they will likely have no impact on your career. Visible tattoos are typically found on the hands, neck, and face. They are increasing in prevalence. Of the 18 to 29-year-old cohort, nearly 40% have tattoos, and of that 40%, about a third are visible. I wanted to find out how those visible tattoos affect your chances of getting a job. I initially interviewed 15 hiring managers in service sector organizations in Scotland. The industries in my sample include retail, hotels, prison services, landscaping, restaurants, higher education, booksellers, a beauty salon, and a bank, among others. I also interviewed another 10 visibly tattooed respondents about their job-seeking experiences. Several findings stand out. First, tattoos can harm your chances of getting a job, but not necessarily because the recruiter is prejudiced. Some recruiters I spoke with personally like tattoos, but refuse to hire anyone with body art because of customer expectations. It's a problem of societal prejudice, not individual prejudice. Second, tattoos don't always reduce your chances of getting a job. In some industries, they can be an asset, especially where young people are the target demographic. Third, how visible the tattoo is and the genre of the image are also important factors. A tattoo on the hand can be temporarily concealed through body positioning, but not a tattoo on the face. And a rose says something different about your character than a marijuana leaf. So my advice is go ahead and get that new tattoo you've been thinking about, but think long and hard about how it might affect your career.
That was Andrew Timming of the University of St. Andrews. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.